97.9 The Hill, WCHL, and UNC School of Media and Journalism present Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. Sports Focus, dedicated to in-depth examination of issues of overriding importance in the sports world. Each week, we'll discuss problems and look for solutions in professional, collegiate, and amateur sports. From Carroll Hall on the Carolina campus, here's your host, UNC Journalism Professor Charlie Tuggle.
Welcome to Sports Focus. Our topics today, a bill in the Massachusetts legislature that would ban tackle football for players younger than 14, and the controversy surrounding college admissions and falsified athletics credentials. Our guest, Kevin Guskowitz, a renowned expert about head trauma and the recently named interim chancellor of UNC Chapel Hill. First of all, congrats, I don't envy you.
I'm enjoying it.
So this bill that would ban tackle football for players younger than 14, this is not the first time this has been attempted. Other state legislatures have put similar bills forward. None has passed, but this one from the get-go has bipartisan support. Do you support that from a scientific point of view, banning tackle football for kids younger than 14?
Well, as I've said, I've never been a fan of putting an age on this issue. I have had, as I've told you before, I have three sons, and at age 13, 14, they each looked very different in terms of height and weight and their sort of aggressiveness, on a football field. So I do think that playing at age, 8, 9, 10, which is where many kids started playing, I think that probably should be banned, tackle football at that age. I'm a little bit worried about the age 13 or 14, because I think if you're going to play in high school, you need to be able to prepare yourself to protect yourself during those younger years. And what's the right age? Is it 12, 13, 14? That's whenever our motor skills really are developing and developing the muscle memory that I believe helps to protect you later.
So you've dealt with a lot of former pro players who, if they played tackle football in Little League and on through middle school, high school, into college, and then pros, they're getting hit in the head repeatedly for 20 years in a row. And something I think that really bears on this is that several really good pro players have said, don't start so early, and you can still be successful because these particular players didn't start playing tackle football until they were in high school. So of the players that you're working with through the CTE studies, what do you think some of them would say about this?
Well, I think that nine out of every 10 that we've had through the Center for the Study of Retired Athletes at Carolina has said that they'd do it all over again. And, regardless of the state that they're in today, and many of them are doing just fine today. I do think that the leagues are doing a much better job of reducing the amount of contact during practices. Most Pop Warner now, I think it's no more than 1/3 of any practice, or perhaps another in some other leagues, it's no more than 30 minutes in a given practice. And so there's a lot of rules right now that are regulating the amount of contact in a given practice. And I think that's a very good policy.
You and I have talked about this subject several times before. But I remember distinctly, and this has been 45 years ago, seeing stars in a football practice and thinking, well, that's what football's supposed to be. You're supposed to be tough. You're supposed to be mean. If you get dinged in the head, that's just par for the course. But there's so much evidence now that says we need to do what we can to protect players from that.
That mentality today, I would label as stupidity. Quite honestly, we have come so far in terms of advancing the science and educating athletes about the signs and symptoms of a concussion. So any player today that would suggest that seeing stars or feeling as though their bell's been rung is just part of the game, they shouldn't be playing the game.
Can kids learn, and some of the advocates behind this bill say they can learn the skills portions of football by playing flag football? And it's wise to make them wait before they start experiencing head contact.
I love the fact that flag football has become much more popular, and I do believe, based on the you know, some of the motor learning literature, and I think over time we're going to see some research evolving to show, you know, what exactly how a player can be prepared by better prepared at age 15, 14, 15, 16 by having played flag football. So I think that data is still emerging. So I think we have to continue that path. I'm a fan of flag football.
You've made this point on our show before, but it's so important, I think, that I'd like for you to make it again. No helmet is designed to protect against concussion. It's designed to protect against skull fracture.
Skull fractures and brain bleeds. And so, as I tell people all the time, there's no concussion-proof helmet out there. There's no concussion-proof mouth guard. There's no padding that can be placed on a helmet inside or outside that is going to prevent concussion. They do a wonderful job of protecting against catastrophic brain injury, which is the skull fractures and brain bleeds. And we can't expect them to stop the movement of the brain inside the skull.
Because that's what happens at high velocity contact. Explain that just briefly. What happens to the brain itself?
Well, the brain essentially sloshes around inside the cerebrospinal fluid within the skull. And anytime there's an acceleration or a deceleration, that brain sloshes around and it becomes distorted or deformed.
And it hits up against the sides of the skull itself?
It hits against the skull, but you can even have within the brain tissue, you have the neurons. You know, there are, you know, over, you know, 86 billion neurons in the human brain, and they become distorted. And if we don't allow them to sort of take their normal shape and function, they can disintegrate if we don't allow them to heal properly.
Sports Focus, we'll be right back.
You're listening to Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. And now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sports Focus and our discussion with the interim chancellor of UNC Chapel Hill, Kevin Guskowitz. We were talking about brain trauma. Now we're going to switch gears and talk about this scam that people were running, trying to use fake athletics credentials to get their students into universities. And in some of the cases, the students had never played that particular sport. And yet some coach allowed them to get an athletic scholarship. It has to be true that these folks, whether it's true or not, but these folks thought that the side door, the way to get in, is through athletics. Why would they think that?
I have to tell you, Charlie, I was shocked by this, appalled by it. I think as anybody involved in higher education would be. I don't know. I honestly haven't had a lot of time given my new assignment. I'm sort of worried about what's happening here at UNC Chapel Hill. And so I just haven't had a chance to really try to analyze what actually happened there, but it was appalling.
So they're faking credentials. Well, number one, they get other people to take the test for them. But specifically, because this is a sports-oriented talk show, the idea that a coach can be bought and give a non-athlete a slot on a team that could have gone to a true athlete. So people are missing out all around because of the misconduct of some of these folks, including some coaches. Yeah. What should we as educators in the academy do when athletics gets off the rail?
Well, I think we have to be sure that you have all the checks and balances in place. You need to have, you know, faculty committees such as we have here at UNC Chapel Hill in place that look at the admissions of special talent cases such as we have for not just athletes, but for the marching band and for dramatic art and some other subgroups of students that bring special talents. And so we have special admissions committees that that actually review these cases to be sure that we can ensure that every kid who is admitted can, in fact, be successful here at UNC Chapel Hill. And I think we have a wonderful program in place. And we went through, as you know, several reforms that were put in place back in about 2011, 2012. And we're very proud of the program that we have for admissions of students in general, but especially of student athletes.
One lesson I think you would agree that UNC learned during that time is trust but verify. And that's the situation that we have here. You trust the coach to do the right thing, but it would be so easy to verify whether he or she was doing the right thing. If Johnny Smith, you know, got a scholarship for soccer, it's pretty easy to tell whether Johnny Smith is going to soccer practice or actually knows how to play soccer. I don't get this.
Yeah, this is an entirely new sort of twist, and you know, to the some of the challenges that that we faced with the NCAA and admissions of student athletes. But I think one of the things that hopefully we'll learn globally speaking from this latest situation is that it appears that many of the sports that were involved were some of the Olympic sports, the non-revenue sports, as they're referred to quite often. And it seemed as if, again, with the very little reading that I was able to capture from it, that those sorts of teams were coaches were taking money. And there is a lot of disparity between the you know, men's and women's basketball, football, the revenue generating sports and those non-revenue generating sports. And you know, were they feeling the need in this case to take money? You know, I think we can figure that out and be sure that there's more balance in terms of what the non-revenue sports or perhaps how they're resourced. And that's just some of what came out of this latest case.
Sure, you have athletics administrators, you have compliance officers, you have all these folks who are supposed to be making sure that the athletes go to class and do those kinds of things. I guess now they're going to have to check and see, does this person really know how to play the sport? Or what's this name? Where did this name come from? I don't know this person. Why is this person on our roster?
Yeah, I think while I am certain that is not happening here at UNC Chapel Hill, I'm just assuming that they're going to have to be policies put in place, checks and balances to look at this. And it seems pretty simple in terms of looking at who you have admitted as a student athlete on scholarship and if they are, in fact, on the roster.
Southern Cal was mentioned quite a bit in the indictments. I was talking to somebody last week or the week before from Wake Forest, and a writer. And he said it's interesting that some folks at Wake Forest are seeing this sort of as a badge of honor that they're included in the conversation with Southern Cal and Northwestern. And I don't think I'd consider that a badge of honor to be in that company in this particular instance.
I would agree. But again, it's hard. I can't really speak for what other universities are doing with regard to this, how they're responding to it or how they're framing the situation. So I'm just happy that we have a great program in place here in Chapel Hill, and confident that we're going to continue to be a leader in this area and a model, I think, for how other universities can have the right checks and balances in place.
Sports Focus. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle, and now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sports Focus. We're talking with Interim Chancellor Kevin Guskowitz of UNC Chapel Hill, and we're talking about the controversy surrounding admissions, falsified athletics credentials. And Kevin, I wanted to ask you about, this is a highly selective university, especially for out-of-state students. 18% is the most we can accept of our incoming student body. People want to come here. They desperately want to come here. And to a degree, I suppose, I can understand someone whose son or daughter has said, this is it. This is the school I want and no other. I can almost see the impetus to do whatever it takes to get that student into that school, but that doesn't do the student any good in the long run. And why has it, I'm asking you to be a psychologist, but why would someone get to that point that if Johnny doesn't get into school XYZ, his life is ruined?
Yeah, I mean, I think we live in such a society where we're so driven. Our children are driven to succeed, and some of that, a lot of that, probably comes from the parents setting expectations so high these days. And again, I'm a parent of four, and I tried to do everything to support my kids where they wanted to go to school. But I would never want my child to go to a school where I didn't think he or she could be successful. And that's why our admissions policy here in practice is, I think it's very comprehensive in that it looks at not only GPA and test scores, there's a holistic approach to this in terms of, you know, how they're, you know, can they succeed in this rigorous academic environment at Chapel Hill? So, that mentality's there, and sometimes kids will do everything, or parents perhaps, obviously after what we learned last week, will do anything to try to push, create a pathway for their child, to be there. And the sad part is that many of those kids end up being unsuccessful because they're in an environment where they can't be successful because of the rigorous academic standards.
I mentioned that I can almost, and emphasis on almost, see getting to that point. What is clear is how everyone else is reacting, because this story has been front page for a week and a half, and that doesn't happen in the 24/7 news cycle. Why is this story forefront? Because it's unfair. People don't like unfairness, and they're seeing people who had every advantage there was to have taking even more advantage. Is that what it's come to try to get kids into the top universities?
Well, I think it's, imagine being a kid who didn't get admitted. And again, there are schools like UCLA where my understanding is they have 55 to 60,000 applicants a year. Now, I don't believe they were mentioned in this, scandal last week. But, if they only admit each year 5 or 6,000, think about the number of applicants who get turned away. I mean, at UNC Chapel Hill, we had nearly 45,000 applications this year, set another record. Each year, it seems like we're 5, 6, 7% higher than what we were the year before, for only about 4,200 spots. So if you're one of those kids that's not being admitted, and then you later find out that there was some scandal that allowed a kid to get in, such as what has happened at a number of these schools, I can see how it'd be extremely frustrating.
So the third angle I'd like to look at, first it was the parents who would do anything. There's everybody else who are ticked off at the parents who would do anything. And then you have the sports fans who are thinking, don't you dare give a spot to a kid who's not an athlete, because we intend to win a national championship and we need every single person on that team to be someone who can contribute to that team. So from a sports fan perspective, I think people would be upset. So it's actually fascinating to me that this story has resonated for the length of time that it has resonated.
Sure. I mean, it's, as I've often said, negative news tends to make headlines, and so they tend to stick around a little bit longer. And this is certainly an ugly, sad story, to be honest with you. I mean, I think what I was most saddened by with this is the not about how a fan is thinking about it, but about an actual applicant who later found out that their parent had put together this scam, scheme, if you will, to get them admitted to a school where they're likely not going to be successful. It's hard for me to view it from the lens of a fan. I felt most sad for the applicant, those kids who many, as I understand it, didn't know that this had all transpired.
The new head coach of the men's national team in soccer was a walk-on at Carolina, right? And then went on to play pro ball and is now the coach of the national team. He was a walk-on. I could see and blossomed when he got here. Wasn't highly recruited. You could see a situation that a kid, a true athlete, but not the greatest of athletes, gets knocked out, doesn't have the opportunity because of what these parents did. So, I think it's the unfairness that really sits with people. And it's like, you had every advantage possible. Why would you go here?
Yeah. This is all speculation, and I understand that walk-ons. We've had a lot of walk-ons at Carolina over the years who have gone on to in a number of sports who have been very successful, and those are always feel-good stories when it happens. It's a little different from what you're describing, I understand, but just overall, I think a sad situation, and I hope that those schools that are out there that where this happened, that it'll be fully investigated, and they'll be able to put some of the policies and checks and balances in place so that they can be assured that it'll never happen again.
That does it for this edition of Sports Focus. Thanks to our guest, Kevin Guskowitz, Thanks also to engineer Gary Kirk. And as always, thanks to you for listening. Cheers.
Thanks to Richard Southall, Mark Nagel, and Deborah Southall at the College Sport Research Institute at the University of South Carolina for their research and guidance and for access to CSRI's international network of sources. Sports Focus is a service of UNC School of Media and Journalism.